Okay, we'll start, I guess. We have a full room now. Good afternoon. My name is Ajay Kumar. I'm a researcher at the Adaptive Systems and Interaction Group at Microsoft Research. And today, I'm very proud to have three amazing speakers talking about human-AI collaboration. And Barbara Gross yesterday gave a great keynote kicking us up on this topic and what kind of capabilities do we need from systems that are going to be collaborating with humans and how it is different than systems that are just going to accomplish some tasks on their own. And this topic is becoming even more critical for us at Microsoft, where one of our missions now is augmenting human intelligence through AI. So we are going to start by having three short talks from Eric Horvitz, from Milan Tambe, and from Rao Kampramati. On their research, but then we are going to have at least half an hour at the end of the session discussing what they've talked about and other things maybe that didn't come up during the talks. So please think about what questions you have for the speakers. If you have something particular for them, we are going to accept a few questions after their talks. But please think about what are the harder questions you would like to ask to all three speakers keep them for the end of the session. So we are going to start with Eric Horvitz. Eric doesn't have an introduction. He's been introduced a few times already, at least twice. And okay. Two more introductions are going to come this afternoon. But Eric Horvitz is a technical fellow at Microsoft, and also he's managing labs, MSRAI.
That's it.
And our group too, right. Adaptive Systems and Interaction. So, Eric.
But by the way, the next two sessions, I'm introducing other people, so I think I'm sharing them. So I thought I'd just be very brief today, but just amplify a couple of things I said yesterday and point out some great opportunity areas for building deeper human-AI collaboration, models of people and tasks, models of complementarity, and coordination of initiative. There's a whole community called user modeling. And even that community, I think, has just barely scratched the surface about what it means to build, with our representations and our inference machinery, systems that could continue to operate side by side with people as they work on tasks, and both interpret the state of a task as well as human goals and needs. If you can do that well, you can imagine you can do all sorts of things. And over the years, we could go through a long list of our attempts to build user models, probabilistic user models that could take desktop activity, data structures changing state in various kinds of software, including Microsoft Office software, like Excel, for example. And that would compute probability distributions over things like goals, sets of goals users might have over time and sequences of goals, tasks, competencies, particular needs for decision support, for example. And I decided to keep some of the examples out of the deck right now. I want to just mention these high-level principles and then show some videos and have you think through what the videos mean. But the basic idea is you can imagine you can... Some of that work that I find the most interesting dimension of this kind of effort in modeling was building systems that can model the world with lots of sensors and then model human beliefs about the world and then use both of those distributions to drive decision support. I mentioned yesterday's idea of complementarity. I like this picture where I think about all of cognitive psychology over the years, identifying what makes us human in terms of our cognition and our abilities and limitations across memory, attention, and judgment, among other areas, ability to attain concepts, visualization. There's great literature out there. But thinking through what's been done to date with complementarity, we, again, barely scratched the surface. Ajay Kumar and I did some fun work a few years ago with Galaxy Zoo, where we actually considered the competencies of a vision system and detailed competencies of different people coming into a citizen science system to create joins. But here's an example of what we see becoming more popular now. So last year, there was something called the Chameleon Grand Challenge, asking, based on a big data set of pathology slides of lymph nodes, can you build a system that could detect metastatic breast cancer in lymph node sections? That was the grand challenge. And of course, you had normals and metastatic cancer. And the best automated system was a convolutional neural network, but the human was superior. But then in the paper, the last few paragraphs of this paper, after they celebrate the results and talk about the human being superior, they say, well, wait a minute. If we actually have a very simplistic algorithm that combines the output of the neural net and the output of the human beings as they look through their slides, they can dramatically reduce the error. I mean, that's a dramatic reduction in error for a lot of patients. Again, that's a very simplistic approach. We're not thinking about the details, what happened, what's been going on. You can imagine going further if you actually dug into the black box of the two intellects and the combination of their skills. Here's another example. I think it's interesting. I was talking to Murray Campbell last year at a conference. Murray Campbell was on the Deep Blue team. And he said, well, here's where we are today with chess. If you look at blitz, 5 second per move blitz chess, 30 second per move rapid chess, classical 3 minute per move, and then correspondence chess, which I wasn't very familiar with. It's like apparently 3 days or more by email or US post snail mail. But the idea is that human beings are in the blue here. You see that computers back in 1997 began to dominate. But look at the green here with human plus computer and what happens with correspondence chess, where people have time to think through and play with computers. Now, I asked Murray, I said, has anybody ever built a computer system to play chess that was built to augment human chess playing versus just being a chess playing machine? The answer was no, not that he knew of. And my thought was, wow, if you can do that, if you built a machine that could search, for example, show a human being visual search spaces and help a human do A-B compares, not just play many games, couldn't you do much better with that kind of a centaur-like system? Just a question that I have looking forward. So on complementarity, there's back to the literature again. There's really fabulous cognitive psychology I want to really promote again and again here. For example, work by Sperling, who I consider a colleague now, down in Irvine, and Milchner, when they were both at AT&T Bell Labs, did work on something called the attention operating characteristic curve, where they would give human beings a dual task challenge, like two visual search tasks, and push them hard and give them an objective function, and find out what human beings could do when it came to divided attention, for example, and how this kind of knowledge could help us think through, for example, divided attention scenarios where we demand users to deal with an alert and back to their Word document and so on. This is a little kind of, just a piece of the tip of the iceberg of that work. Now talking about the complementarity is one piece, right? But then there's how do you inject the intellect into problem solving with a human being? And this is coordination of initiative. How do you coordinate? So the way, just to use my blob, I like to think in blobs, I guess, or maybe that's my artistry. But here's a problem at the user's focus of attention here. Imagine a really smart computer someday that says, hey, I see that blob, and I can decompose it into subproblems alpha and beta, and I can't touch alpha. That's very human. I know that. I can help you with beta, though. And there's a whole communication strategy. I'm going to do beta, alpha, let's recurse. And can we build systems that understand how to help decompose and provide this a volley of initiative in solving problems? Subscribing to principles of complementarity and so on. Now, it turns out that there's been some really nice work, some of it pretty formal, by psychologists who are psychologists of conversation, like Herb Clark. And they talk about this idea of, and they talk about conversation, but let's just map this to problem solving, because it's the same kind of thing here. And they talk about, in a conversation, and we have several people from the SIGDAL community here who know this stuff very well, there's the idea of contributing to the conversation with conceptually in a back and forth volley. This is Herb Clark and Duncan and Goffman and Goodwin. But here's a picture that's often drawn, I think due to Clark originally, where there's multiple layers that need to be to work on to ground with another human they talk about, but let's talk about this with human machine, where a channel is established, like we're gonna communicate now, I'm talking to you, engagement. There's a signal, so there's a signal detected. Let's say I'm talking to you now, the words are being processed. There's an intention, that's the meaning behind the words. And then there's the actual back and forth, the volley of what's expected, who goes next, and who's going to contribute, who's going to listen now, this multi-level process. And I like to look at the top piece here. I'll rename it flow of initiative for any kind of AI human collaborative system. So I think Greg Hager's here. Where's Greg? Greg, so I'm on the advisory board. I'm very proud of Johns Hopkins CS department. And so I can sort of lay some pride in talking about some of the work that you've done, Greg, with your team here. But let's go to healthcare for a very concrete example of a physical, we'll lay out a physical example, but the metaphor is a metaphor for anything, any kind of collaboration. But I love this work by Carol Riley and others. I guess she was a master's student when she did this, correct? Yeah. So what Carol and team did is they looked at taking some imagery of surgery, and they were reasoning about a grammar of surgery. One of the first steps you need to sort of accomplish in coordinating initiative would be to recognize state. And so the idea of being able to, an HMM model they use to recognize a reaching needle situation. So it's a human being doing this action, and a machine is recognizing the state of, in a surgical process, insertion, a left transfer, a loosening. And if you knew these states, and I'm not sure, and Greg maybe can comment later about this, how much that this has been used in actual larger scale coordination, but if you could actually recognize state and you had a robotic surgeon that was going to work with you, and this was Children's Hospital, like it's a year and a half ago in a Science Translational Medicine paper, work with you on a surgical repair here, humans working with a machine. This is an anastomosis repair, which is a very complex repair in surgery. It's two tubes being sewn together, like an intestine, cut in the middle and reassembled. But it's interesting to see there's a robotic system that's looking at the seams here and so on, and then there's a back and forth, a kind of a volley between the human and the machine. And again, I'm not sure how much coordination the machine was doing here, but you can imagine where this is going someday. So I wanted to show you just a few videos now. I'm going to probably go a little faster. A few videos, and just this is work with, and Dan Bohus, are you Dan here somewhere? Yeah, that's Dan. Work with that Dan led up. I think I need to click on these. But we built a trivia system that would, for a variety of reasons, you can read about this work, but we were looking at coordination between people and machines where IBM did the Jeopardy system. We did like the Trebek moderator system, right? So we're going to give you the view out to the two individuals, the human subjects who gave us permission to release this, and their view from the machine in a second here.
Next question. Libya is the only country...
The red dot is the gaze of an avatar.
What color is it? Do you think same?
Yes.
That's right. So far you have one correct answer. Now on to the next question.
So that's the view from the machine out. Now you get a better idea what's going on here.
So far you have one correct answer. Now on to the next question. In the U.S., a hospitals have a Red Cross. What sign do they use in the Arab world?
Solid blue circle.
Is that correct?
No.
So what's the correct answer?
Red crescent moon.
Yes.
That's right.
So just now, she, being very anthropomorphic here, turned to the young man and said, raise her eyebrow. And it was very fluid. He agreed, yes. He knew what was going on, and you can imagine signaling, even subtle microstructure of signaling can be very important in collaboration. Here's an example that highlights the importance of miles of attention in our AI systems, some data coordinating with people. Dan and Eric are the actors here.
Do you need help finding something?
Yes.
Could you tell me the room number or person you're looking for?
I think it's 4800.
To get to 4800.
No, I think it's 4300.
Are you sure?
4300, yeah.
Excuse me.
4300.
Go along that hallway.
I'm looking for 4300.
So just a little bit of an annotation here.
I think it's 4800.
To get to 4800.
So here is the attention of Dan. And we're saying here right now, the system actually is waiting, but it waits long. It times out and then says, excuse me.
Excuse me.
And now it's gonna wait again, but it's gonna actually try to get, it's gonna use a very interesting technique from Goodwin. It's gonna stutter and try to get attention back.
Go along that hallway.
That was very explicit in terms of the design of the system. And if you think that's just acting here, here is in the wild, again, with permission.
Take the elevator down to the second floor. Turn left as you walk out of the elevator and continue on to the end of that hallway. Excuse me.
Isn't that cool? It's pausing for the glance.
Huh? Excuse me. Can I help you find something?
Can you tell me?
Morning. Do you need directions? Excuse me. Do you need directions?
How to get to 222.
Okay, so here's another kind of signaling that's going on, and again, I'm going to ask you which you like better as human beings. This is a multi-level graph of uncertainty over time, entropy over time, in several levels of a conversation for the uncertainty a system has in the visual signal, what's being said, the who goes next in a conversation. And here's the other version of it now. We use the same kind of signals to drive facial expressions to commit to transmit uncertainty. This is the assistant by my door. We call her Monica. We have a male version called Chad. So it's very equal representation here. Watch her facial expressions.
Hi there. Are you here looking for Zach?
Yes.
Are you here for the 2 o'clock meeting with Zach? Sorry, did you say you were here for the 2 o'clock meeting with Zach?
Yes.
Is one of you John?
Yes.
Sorry, I can't tell who is speaking when you stand so close together. Which one of you said there, John?
I did.
Right. Hi, John. Zach is expecting you. Will you be joining the meeting? Will you be joining the meeting?
Yes.
All right. I've let Zach know you'll be joining his meeting with John. I'm sorry. I think Zach is running a little bit late. I'm pretty sure he's on his way.
So I think what's interesting is to think that I love the fact that we did this with Tomislav, who is an intern working with us, is it 3 summers ago now? It's kind of scary, Dan. But what's magical is that it's entropy signals spread over variables of uncertainty about what's going on directly controlling musculature. And I love the fact we had this running, you're looking right down the heart of the probability distributions, and it looks very natural. And it really is doing what people do when they communicate about first levels of uncertainty. I thought I'd end briefly by going back to my first year at Microsoft. We did a user study. It was the Microsoft Intelligent Assistant Study, and let me set it up very briefly. We have Andrew Quatnitz, who became a GPM at Office, and finally retired like maybe 8 or 9 years ago. He is playing the role in this case. We did a whole week of these studies in a secret soundproof booth. soundproof booth. And he can't hear a subject who's going to be given an Excel task. And she's like a medium level Excel user. She's given a task on a page of paper. We asked both of them to basically do protocol analysis, to talk out loud about what they were thinking. And we asked Andrew, do your best to magically, through an interface you can type in, help this person complete their task. I want everyone, as I play this, just a few minutes of it I'll just play, think through initiative, complementarity, and coordination of what you would do, what kind of agent you would build to help out this woman. And again, after this week, we did a full report on what we learned, which I think was very interesting in terms of the findings. Let me move forward here. Here we go.
All right, I'm going to move over days and nights away. Ooh,
And this person's very good at keyboard shortcuts. Or they're very proficient at selection, so you don't really need help there. Not sure what they did with that. They're trying to center that. I wish I could see their whole sheet all at once. Okay, row height. So I'm gonna give them a direct, that they can just drag the row and column headers. You can just drag the row
and column
headers.
And then it goes over the bottom table. Okay, so
width.
I'll find a place to put it. I'll go down to the bottom table, make sure there's space here.
They might have one set specific one,
okay,
but
just drag the row of column headers to change the height or width.
Looks like they were just guessing.
You can just drag the row or column up to the column header. I'm not sure that applies to this task.
I wonder if they're trying.
What this means. Okay, I don't know how to do that. Let's see.
I'm going to say if you're trying to combine.
If you're trying to combine multiple sheets into one file, create a new workbook using
file new
workbook. Oh, I've never used this.
Now they're doing it. They must want to do that.
All right.
Now say, now use add.
Anyway, it was really interesting to watch hours of these videos and watch when people did sync. It was amazing, because then they started like, they're doing it, and they were sort of signaling back and forth. And you can tell there was a sync, but before the sync would happen, there'd be all this guessing, and no, this is distracting. It's like a paper clip of some kind, which actually came out of this work. Anyway, so, okay, so I'll stop there, but I wanted to just leave you with these examples. Thank you.
So we have time for one or two questions if you have anything specific to ask to Eric.
Yeah, David.
So you're talking, several I've seen earlier today, sort of look at sort of more human-like behaviors and sort of simulating human behaviors in order to get the user's attention, get them to behave certain ways. And it's got me wondering whether that's going to also come with perhaps costs. Like suddenly people are going to invest time in being polite to an entity, which it's not helping that entity when you're being polite to them, and it may be slowing you down or making you frustrated or something.
By the way, I disagree with your first comment. There was no notion of us trying to get people. It was trying to be fluid and be more natural-like in this particular situation.
Right, I understand, but that fluidity was sort of through trying to get the system to act like a human, so that people would respond to it in sort of humanistic ways. And I'm wondering if there are more fluid ways if you want to treat it as a tool instead of simulating a human being. Does that increase the fluidity or decrease it?
It's a good question, David. I think that I could have picked examples of Cortana circles floating through the walls. We have these ambient projects now that have this really fun Cortana circle that's on the walls, and it has different kinds of symbols coming out of it. And the whole idea of whether it's anthropomorphic, I think it's a separate issue. I was trying to more focus on, and maybe with these examples you got thinking about the naturalistic part, but it's more the coordination, the signaling. You can imagine LED lights instead of eyebrows flashing, and maybe that would be less distracting to people. Maybe someday you have to pick your interface, and some people will want this anthropomorphic-like experience, some people want the flashing LED, which is the attention light. We've had one of our projects was called Deep Listener, before deep learning was even a big thing. It was an interaction with Deep Blue, and it had just a HAL lens. You know, the HAL red lens of the HAL 2000, and it would turn, as you were talking to it, it would go from green, which meant with a shine on it, you know, glass, to like, it would go yellow, slow down, and turn red, and it would get confused, it would turn different colors. So it's like, you watch this thing, and people got very, it was a very natural experience to have this, like, expression, to map expressions and uncertainty to the color of the lens. But it's a good question.
Okay, thank you, Eric. Let's have our second speaker. Our next speaker is Milan Tambe from University of Southern California. In addition to being a professor in the engineering department, he is also a founding co-director of USC's Center for AI in Society. Milan is a AAAI fellow and ACM fellow, and I've been admiring Milan's work since my early days of my PhD because in addition to doing a lot of theoretical contributions to the field, he also has been very successful in putting his work into the real world by helping the Coast Guard to become more secure, you know, delivering his ideas into LAX Airport and also for environmental protection.
Hello. Right. Thank you for coming to my presentation. So I'm going to be talking about the essential role of human-machine partnerships in domains of AI for social good. This is work that was conducted at our USC Center for AI in Society. And this is a center that's a collaboration between our School of Engineering and our School of Social Work. I'm a co-director from the AI side. And Eric Rice from Social Work is a co-director from the social work side. Our mission is to advance AI research driven by the 13 grand challenges of the American Academy of Social Work and Social Welfare. I'm not listing all of them. There's only a few that I've listed here, but they include big things like ending homelessness and achieving equal opportunity and justice and so forth. The UN, the international version of this is the UN Sustainable Development Agenda. Now, of course, these are big, big grand challenges. What can we practically do? And so I'm going to highlight three major areas of work at our center. I'll start with the work that we've been doing for building AI assistants for low-resource communities. And here, I'll emphasize the word AI assistants because we are building assistance decision aids. And so this is a concrete project here is work with the homeless shelters in LA. One big challenge is spreading information about HIV amongst homeless youth. Harnessing their social network, we can show that AI algorithms are far more effective in spreading such information. But not only is there more spread of information about HIV, but we get to this end state where these happy young people that are shown here, and I'll come to this, this is an important point of this research. But there's other projects in this area intervening for substance abuse prevention, suicide prevention, and so forth. So that's one big area of our work. Another is AI assistance for conservation. And so one concrete problem here is in work that we've been doing with the Wildlife Conservation Society and Uganda Wildlife Authority, and this is in Uganda. We're trying to predict where poachers place snares in order to trap animals. If we can predict accurately and get rangers to patrol and remove those snares, we can potentially save lives of animals. We've done a long experiment recently, for example, multiple months, where we've been able to successfully predict such snares, remove these snares, get poachers arrested, and potentially save lives of animals. There's other projects, for example, drone patrols in South Africa, where we can detect where poachers and animals are, so we can send rangers to try to interdict them. In the past, we've run projects with the U.S. Coast Guard to patrol in the Gulf of Mexico against illegal fishing and interdict in illegal logging in Madagascar with an NGO there. A third area of our work is AI assistance for public safety and security. This has been a long-standing area of our work. Big challenge is that we have a large number of targets, not enough security resources. How do you schedule or plan or allocate limited resources? We are appealing to game theory and solving a large-scale game. We can then create patrolling schedules. This is, for example, our algorithms that work around the Staten Island Ferry. These Coast Guard boats that patrol, they've completely changed the way how the Coast Guard used to patrol this. This is after solving a spatiotemporal game, you get a patrol schedule, and the Coast Guard have been running this. And this is the same algorithms that have been used by the Federal Air Marshal Service to assign air marshals to flights by different law enforcement agencies in the LA area and so on. We're happy to see several of our collaborators now picking up this work, whether in Israel to monitor traffic, in Singapore to patrol the ports, in Buenos Aires Airport. It was funny when we were, well, funny or not, but we were in the Ichca in Buenos Aires and the airport was patrolled using software based on our ideas by the University in Buenos Aires. So these are three major areas of work that we have ongoing. My point here today is to emphasize that in doing this work, there's really a human-machine partnership that we have to emphasize. For example, you'll see in the work, the social workers do their task and the AI system does its task. But the partnership is not only between individual users and software, it's also with the organizations. And so this work requires us in low-resource communities to partner with homeless shelters, with Safe Place for Youth, or My Friend's Place in the LA area. For wildlife conservation, it's organizations like WWF, WCS. And then public safety and security, it's agencies like TSA and the US Coast Guard and other law enforcement agencies. In this talk, I'll primarily focus on our work on low-resource communities. And I'll start with a small video clip from our work to highlight the role of my PhD student, Amulya Yadav, who did majority of the work, and Eric Rice, my collaborator on this work.
At the USC Center for Artificial Intelligence in Society, we are researching ways to leverage the power of social networks to address complex social problems. My colleagues and I have focused on one particular problem: how to use artificial intelligence techniques to prevent the spread of HIV amongst homeless youth. In Los Angeles County, homelessness has reached a crisis level, with nearly 47,000 people experiencing homelessness on any given night.
Homelessness is and has to be our top priority. After all, real lives are on the line.
Sometimes overlooked in this conversation is the increasing number of homeless youth.
There are up to 6,000 homeless young people sleeping on the streets in Los Angeles. These homeless youth are 10 times more likely to be exposed to HIV due to high-risk activities such as unprotected sex and needle sharing.
Among housed youth, less than 0.5% have HIV. Yet among homeless youth, nearly 10% are infected.
Educating all these youth about HIV is a necessity, but this goal is unachievable due to limited resources.
So I'm going to get to what we do about this, but as you can see, since we are close to Hollywood, this was our attempt to be Hollywood. And so when I took this video, full video, and showed it to my family, their response was, please don't do this again. This is not for you. But we did submit the whole video to AAAI. AAAI reviewers fortunately only focused on the technical aspects and not on our acting, and so this worked out well for us. So the challenge here is that we are given a social network. This is not a Facebook network, but this is actually face-to-face network of these homeless youth observed by social workers. This is full of uncertainty. And we have a capacity limit, so we can only bring in, let's say, 5 youth at a time. So we brought them in, we've selected them carefully, and now there's an education session where our social work colleagues educate them about sexual health and condoms and how to communicate this information with their peers. This is a peer-led intervention because these are homeless youth, they're untrusting of adults, and therefore this has to be done by peers. So this is how this session unfolds. So it's a whole long day session. They now are free to go out and spread this information among their peers. But in return, they also give us information about the network. I'm friends with so-and-so. So-and-so is connected to so-and-so. So we get more information about the graph. And that means that we can now be more clever about the next 5 youth that we will select for intervention. And then, again, the same process unfolds. We get more information. And then we bring in the next 5 youth. And so the process is a dynamic process where we gather more information. It's not a one-shot, a single-shot decision problem. And so it's influence maximization in a dynamic, uncertain fashion. And this problem can be solved as a PUMDP. And essentially, the homeless shelter is running this adaptive policy. It chooses youth. When we act, they get us more information. And that means that this policy can then select the next 5 youth. The AI problem here is, of course, solving this massive PUMDP. I wouldn't have time to really go into how we generated this algorithm, but that's the technical contribution. Now, let's look at what happens. First, let's look at it in simulation. These are 2 graphs, homeless youth graphs. On the y-axis is the amount of indirect influence, the non-peer leaders who would be reached by our algorithm. And the 2 dark green lines, these green lines, this is our algorithm, so call it healer, and the others are baseline. The gray in particular is degree centrality, bringing in the most popular youth for intervention. You can see that in simulation, the green lines are much higher. So this is showing that there's promise in our algorithms to do better. Well, what would happen in practice? And so we did a pilot test, bringing in 170 homeless youth, 60 roughly in each condition, two under the AI conditions, and one in degree centrality, bringing in the most popular youth. And so this is the traditional method of how they spread this information about HIV. And so the way this would work is we get a preliminary network from social workers. We run a healer. It'll say, bring in these five youth, in this case, these four youth. They give us more information about the edges in the network. Then we bring in the healer, runs again, brings in the next four youth. And in this way, we got 12 youth to spread information about HIV in this network. So we did this, and the question now is, who got to more youth in the process? So we are now looking at non-peer leaders, the people we did not bring in for intervention. The AI algorithms, Healer and Healer++, has shown reach about 70% of the non-peer leaders. The traditional method, degree centrality, the popularity approach, it reaches up just about 25%. So clearly, the AI algorithms are able to reach a larger fraction of the non-peer leaders. But does this getting this information actually lead to changing of behaviors? And here it's showing, if you look at the proportion of the dark green bar that started testing for HIV, again with the AI algorithms, a larger fraction of youth started testing for HIV. And with the earlier approach, here we got no convergence starting to test for HIV. So why does this happen? And this is an important point. These AI algorithms are looking for people in far corners of the network. The popular approach, the degree centrality approach, it sort of brings in people who are well connected to each other. So if you look at the percentage of edges between peer leaders themselves, these are useless edges. They don't really transmit useful information because they're among peer leaders who we are already bringing in for intervention. So this degree centrality here is like 20%. With Healer and Healer++, they're going to far corners, and therefore they don't have edges amongst these peer leaders, and that's saving, and that's very important because that information transmission is not wasted. As another way to look at it, there are different communities in the network. With these AI algorithms, we are getting coverage across different communities, and with this most popular approach, we are not. Why is this important? I'll come to that in a minute. But let me first show you a testament from our partner, Alison Hurst, of Safe Place for Youth.
Beautiful way to kind of like marry this tech world with this social service world, like, and how we can kind of go deeper and impact young people and elevate them.
If this group became a really big thing, it could really help out a lot of youth.
And so the next step here, having done this pilot test, is to do this test with 900 youth, and this has already begun. 300 enrolled under different conditions, Healer and Healer++, three in no condition, null condition, and three with 300 with the most popular approach. Now let's come back to this picture of the smiling youth. So one of the things that was very interesting that we noticed is people who were selected by these AI algorithms, there's actually a different kind of an impact on them. In fact, some of these people actually changed, they turned their lives around, they felt empowered, they have stable jobs, these youth in particular have houses and so forth. And so my colleague, my collaborator Eric Reisman points out that picking youth as peer leaders was changing their self-esteem and the sense of confidence. So we often talk about AI algorithms bringing in biases that are negative. Here's a bias that's been brought in by this AI algorithm that's positive. These were youth that were not traditionally seen by the housing agency. These were not people who were spotted by the homeless shelters. They were in the far corners, but they were playing an important role. And these AI algorithms picked them up and in this way actually helped them change their lives. So I think this is, we have to be careful when we talk about biases because the biases can go both ways. There's a lot of other work that's going on in the center. I'm not gonna be able to cover everything. For example, substance abuse prevention, again using social network, trying to help with suicide prevention, matching homeless youth to homes in LA. This is a project that's started this summer, trying to think about North Korean refugees settling down in South Korea, modeling TB spread in India, and modeling gang violence in Los Angeles. I wanted to very briefly, in 1 or 2 minutes, also talk about a completely different problem and a completely different kind of AI assistant. And here I wanted to talk about wildlife poaching in Uganda with our colleagues in Wildlife Conservation Society and Uganda Wildlife Authority. I'll just highlight main results. So this is a beautiful place. This is Murchison Falls National Park. Wonderful animals. There's threats to wildlife, snares, thousands of them that get placed to attack these animals. So our task is to predict, given a grid over the park, in each grid square, how likely is it that the poachers would attack? We're given these features, and we're trying to predict where snares would be placed so that rangers could remove them and save these animals. So this is first just showing you in simulation. This is training data over the past several years and looking at what would happen, how well would we predict attacks in 2015. And the dark green bar is our best model. You can see that it's significantly more accurate compared to others and standard machine learning models that we threw at this problem. But this was simulation. We also did tests in the wild. And so this is, we would tell them, okay, go to find these snares. And here, for example, this ranger has found a snare. You can see that this is not a very easy task, them going out to find these snares, but helping them locate this is important. And so we chose 2 9-square-kilometer areas in our pilot test where we predicted hotspots, which they were not patrolled. And so we said, here's where you go, and you will find snares. And they hadn't patrolled these areas frequently before, and we were pretty good in predicting what was going on in these. A poached elephant was found. We were too late to save this elephant. But next, they found a whole snare roll of elephants. So what this means is poachers were active in this area. They were poaching elephants. But before the next elephants could be killed, we were able to remove these snares and hopefully save lives of elephants. We also found 10 antelope snares here. A next test was a 6-month test where we created these 27 different areas of 9 kilometers square each. Some were predicted to be high, some were predicted to be low. And the goal here was to get the rangers to walk these and find snares. The rangers didn't know which one was which, meaning which were predicted to be high attack areas and which were to be low. And we found our catch per unit effort, this is the way we measure this, number of snares found per kilometer. In the high area was 0.11, in the low area 0.01, tenfold difference. So we were pretty accurate in predicting where snares would be found. The traditional, the historical catch per unit effort is 0.04, so certainly we seem to have helped these rangers. There's other side effects. So when the rangers went out in this area, they would find, in one case, they found a trail. They chased the they pursued the trail, found a camp of poachers, ambushed the camp, arrested poachers, confiscated wire snares, and so forth. And there are many interesting findings along the way. But let me now wrap up and talk about what we have learned in general. In this area, it's really important to build these partnerships between humans and machines. Humans focus on their expertise and AI assistants on theirs. Humans, social workers will talk to homeless youth about use of condoms and so forth, and the AI algorithms are figuring out which nodes to select in a social network to transmit this information. In building these assistants, there's got to be a right task division for human versus machine. The AI algorithm is saying, okay, within this 1 square kilometer area, you're going to find snares. But whether it'll be hidden under this bush or this tree, well, that's what the ranger would know, and that's what they focus on. So we leave each with the particular expertise that they have. But there's also this notion of adjustable autonomy. And we have to be right about this in the sense that if we say human is always right, that's not going to work. As I showed, there are wrong biases that human bring to the table. And so sometimes you really want the machines, the AI, to override what the human is really trying to do. And finally, interpretability, transparency, this is really important. You know, even the homeless shelter wants to know, why did you select these youth and not others? Finally, one of the questions that AJ asked was, you know, how would we make these implementations really work? And one of the important points is the partnership is not between only the AI and the user, the particular user, but it's also a partnership between us as researchers and the organization that we are trying to implement this in. Immersion within the organization has helped open our eyes to the challenges they really face and the trust that gets built up. The other thing we notice, of course, is having a champion on the inside of these organizations has really helped us in getting the software out there. So I'll end by saying there's tremendous potential for AI for social good, and if you wanted to come to our website, that's case.usc.edu. Thank you.
We can get a few questions if you have anything you want to say urgently. David?
If nobody else is going to ask questions, I'm happy to. So it was beautiful work to show how you could sort of have this impact on the students, on the homeless youth that you brought in beyond the effect that they had on other people. But is that bringing them in meant that you didn't bring in some other ones, right? So, I mean, so there's some ethical questions there, and also, I mean, these sort of battling utilities for different participants. How did you sort of weigh that?
No, I think this has really been a surprise to us. I mean, the whole point originally was, first of all, thank you for your comments. The original idea was this is purely a way of spreading information about HIV. And it was just a surprise that the people that were brought in with the traditional methods did not have this kind of an impact, but the ones that were being brought in by the PAMDP planner seemed to have changed, behaved differently. They have become more responsible. My collaborator tells us a very interesting story of how this youth that we had selected, the homeless shelter, was like, this person, you're using this person as a peer leader? But then when he was actually called, he was all, sober and really ready to go, activated, and not only did he do his job, but also that seemed to have turned his life around in terms of him finding a stable job. So there's something else going on here that we don't completely understand, but it's an interesting thing to say where, that this is a situation where there is some nice bias, something that the humans were overlooking that the AI algorithm had picked up on. But you're right, there are more complicated issues here that need to be understood. But we are at the beginning stages. It's at least good to see this effect so far.
I'll ask a quick follow-up question. Do these teenagers know that they've been selected by an AI algorithm?
Yes, that's the most interesting part. So there have been cases where we'll go and say, okay, there's two of them. Say, you've been selected as a peer leader. And the other person will say, what about me? I say, well, the algorithm did not select you. Okay, that's fine.
Yeah.
So it's a algorithm. So it's not a human being who did that. So it can go both ways. It can go both ways.
So did you find any interesting, unique patterns among these homeless people? They do have their own communities or not?
That's right. So these graphs have a very particular structure. The youth that hang out together on the beach, the ones that play basketball. So there are smaller communities that are tightly connected with sparse connections to others. And the PAMDP algorithm, the only way to scale it up was really to exploit the fact that there are these communities, and that's how we were able to scale it up. And so there is certainly structure in this graph, and there's a whole lot more that can be done to scale these up, harnessing those to scale up these algorithms.
Let's get the last question, and then Raul can set up in the meantime.
Okay. Do you think it would be possible to take the same approach, but in this case, try to combat the spread of negative information or fake news? So if you were looking at the dissemination networks and understand where the best intervention would be to try to provide additional evidence to combat misinformation.
Certainly, I guess the way this whole work got started was a visit to USC by a major who was serving in Afghanistan, and his problem was that he had to take his 30 members of his unit and spread information about, you know, the U.S. Army and say that, you know, to get the villagers to not support the Taliban. And that was where, you know, this whole work started. And then it turned out along the way that I met Eric, and he said, well, this work can be used for this. Now, we never got the data from Afghanistan, but we did get data for the homeless youth. So there's a significant potential, certainly, for this kind of work. Thank you.
Our next speaker is Rao Kampramani. Rao is a professor at the Arizona State University, and he is the current president of Triple AI. And he is also involved in the partnership of AI.
Okay, thank you for showing up. So AI is very big these days. You know, every day we are just bombarded with news about AI. So for example, you know, you have like CNN is reporting all sorts of important news about like AI helping humans. So you don't believe me, right? I mean, clearly it's fake news. The reason you know it's fake news is not just because AI can't be without drama, but also because we really never have news items about AI helping people. You know, if you look at the way we run our lives, it's more like this, right? So essentially, we take humongous pride when AI systems beat, you know, humans in every possible thing, right? So for example, we have, you know, we beat Kasparov, I mean, that's a lot of news coverage. We beat Liberatus beat the poker guys, that's a lot of news coverage. AlphaGo, poor KG, and Lee Sedol, that's also great news coverage. It's almost as if, you know, AI has this curious ambivalence to human beings, right? So our systems seem happiest either far away from humans, right? Even way before even the most recent AI, you know, hype. You know, we had Spirit and Rover just basically taking over Mars, right? Are, of course, in adversarial stance with humans. So as the, you know, John Lennon said, we want to help humanity, it's just the people that we somehow can't seem to stand, right? Now this, you know, even when we try to force robots to kind of work with humans, all sorts of interesting things are happening. Like, for example, if we force them to cohabit, they either seem to run over us or try to commit harakiri. So this is the kind of situation that we are in, and this has been giving lots and lots of heartburn to, you know, important people like, obviously, you know, Elon Musk, who is again out there talking about how AI is taking over the world and we really need to be worried. I mean, honestly, we need to stop freaking out, Elon, okay? Because otherwise, none of you are going to get your pre-ordered Teslas, right? So we really need to slow him down a bit. So it's important that we work on AI systems that work with humans, if for nothing else, to keep Elon be happy, right? So, you know, back in last year when I was running an international joint conference on AI, so one of the things we did was to have as the special theme for the conference, human-aware artificial intelligence systems, and with the tagline that why intentionally design a dystopian future and spend time being all paranoid about it, right? So that was sort of the tagline, and you know, it looks like, and in fact, there was a very interesting set of activities around this theme, including a very nice panel that, you know, Eric and Barbara and other people were involved. And, you know, after that panel, actually, in fact, there was some sort of a, you know, at least some people seem to have gotten it in the news cycle that human-aware AI could save us from the robocalypse. Apparently, this should, you know, be an important thing to look at. And of course, there are other places where the human-aware AI has sort of gotten back into, and you know, human in-the-loop systems have gotten back into sort of research agendas. The JSON briefing that happened last year essentially brought up the importance for DoD to support human-AI interaction. There was the preparing for the future with AI report that Obama administration did that has a very long discussion of important issues in human-aware AI challenges. Okay, so now the interesting thing is why do we need affirmative action for humans aware AI systems. Why is it that somehow that's not obvious? And I think it's actually worthwhile thinking about this from the point of view of AI, because it's been the case that we somehow feel that putting humans along with AI systems is sort of cheating. We, in the back of our minds, we feel that's somehow cheating. And you know, it doesn't help that the very first human in the loop system, the Mechanical Turk, way in the loop system, human actually was cheating, right? Basically, he was answering all the questions. And you know, for the longest time, in the beginnings of AI, when there was a human in the loop, it was as a crutch to a really badly designed AI system. You know, in fact, in planning my area, we had mixed initiative planning. What it involved is humans actually going into the bowels of the search queues of the planners and trying to kind of shift the search nodes around so that the planner can somehow live to see another day. Okay, so this is the sort of thing that we've been, you know, coming from. And so, like, human in the loop or human aware AI is not like the most obvious thing that we would be thinking about. But so I think that, in fact, it's important for us to take a new look at this, of course. I mean, you know, that we now have AI systems that are, in fact, you know, powerful enough that humans are no longer a crutch. And in fact, taking humans into loop expands the enterprise of AI quite significantly. That's one of the things that I want to consider, you know, push for that. And then that it reduces some of the off-the-top worries about AI. And most importantly, for the masochists, which are researchers, you know, we really want hard problems to solve. And I can tell you there are a large number of hard problems that you haven't even thought about when you're just thinking about autonomous systems. In fact, I show this to my students, that there's a statement that this is saying that this enormously large brains that we have, what we evolved with them not to run away from the tigers of the savannah, but to deal with each other. We are constantly modeling each other's mental states, and this is why we need it, essentially the kinds of brains we have. And so it seems to make more sense that general purpose AI should really actually be thinking about handling humans you know, as partners, because that would be a lot more interesting set of problems to solve. Okay, so even the intro to AI level architecture of an intelligent agent, I'm sure many of you have seen this or taught about this. So there's this whole intelligent agent architecture. The moment you throw in, and in fact, to the extent, you know, if you just focus on pure autonomy, when there are humans, the humans are somewhere in the environment, as if they are like inanimate parts of the environment. But if we start looking at humans as essentially with mental states and intentions and beliefs and desires, which is what you need to actually, you know, interact with them, all of a sudden, the agent architecture becomes way more interesting, way more complicated. You know, essentially, everything that you do, you no longer are just worried about what happens to the inanimate part of the world, but it's also what happens to the people's mental states. You know, how do I do actions that will actually push their mental states in the right direction, and so on. So again, this point is that there is this much bigger scope of AI once you start looking at humans in the loop. So that's sort of the thing that actually, so the first part was to basically show that, you know, it's like, it's a bigger challenge to look at humans in the loop. It's not some sort of a watering down of the AI dream. And then, of course, in my own group, more, you know, in the last, like, you know, 7 or 8 years, we've been actually looking. We somehow discovered humans, and we have started working with them. And so, of course, these are my humans and my robots, and I'm sure you can figure out. This is a new Turing test. Anyway, so the kinds of problems that we look at in my own group essentially include human-in-the-loop planning systems. So, for example, you have you know, mission planning being done by human, you know, mission planners, but with the automated system looking over their shoulder and trying to suggest either changes or to, you know, provide expansions. And to do this right, essentially the system needs to keep track of the intentions of the human planner and also, you know, keep track of the mental state. And that becomes important. Again, this is quite different from the old type of mixed initiative planning systems, where essentially it was the human which was helping the planner rather than the vice versa. So I like to say that in the past, the humans used to go into the land of planners, but the whole point of AI is to get AI machines to come into our land, not us to go into their lands, right? And then, of course, a more fun sort of experiment, sort of applications that we look at are human-machine collaboration in the context of human-robot collaboration. So in this particular case, for example, we have intention recognition, human intention recognition being done. In this case, slightly more directly, the people are wearing emotive, helmets, which just do very simplistic level of P300 brain signals, and even that are enough in some cases to get a sense of what the human was looking at, and you know what in this particular case, you know which block does this guy want versus which block does he want the robot to actually pick. So these are the kinds of things that we can look at. And then there's one more, since I'm actually in Microsoft. This is a HoloLens, which basically can be used, in this particular case, the HoloLens is being used by the robot to actually project its intentions into the sort of the visual field of the human. So not only the humans looking at the common workspace, but they're also getting some additional information about what parts of the workspace that the robot wants to get to. This sort of intention recognition and projection is something that's like a very important part of collaboration. We do that, in day to day. Typically, we tend to do it in a multi-modal way. So sometimes it'll be by language, sometimes by gestures. In this particular case, I just showed you, two specific augmented reality style ways of doing that. But now, we also look at, for example, the bigger sense of these sorts of human-robot collaboration in larger scheme of things, like, for example, search and rescue scenarios. So we actually came up with, recently one time, a variety of scenarios in the search and rescue domain, which look at different ways in which humans and robot collaboration can be facilitated, and with increasing amounts of technical difficulty. So that sort of thing also we look at. And one last plug in this case is to say that there's we have a paper on the archive talking about some of the challenges in terms of this sort of agency, human-aware AI agents. What are the kinds of questions that you look at? Now, talking about challenges, in my remaining few minutes, I want to actually mention some of the challenges from the point of view of planning, and then sort of take any questions. So, one of the biggest things, I'm mostly interested in explainable, agents working, robotic agents or virtual agents working with humans, and so it's not just a one-shot thing. It's a more of a behavior being shown, and the question is, how if a robot is essentially trying to come up with plans of action, normally it has its own model of the world with respect to which it can come up with an optimal plan. The difference when it is actually working in the presence of a human is the human has their own expectation of the model, the capabilities of the robot, which is MH, and the robot is no longer just trying to do what is optimal with respect to its model, but also what is expected by the human because of their approximation of its capabilities. So, and in fact, that leads to two very interesting aspects. If you wind up doing what you are expected to do, then the humans are not spooked and they find your behavior explicable. So it's comprehensible to them. So explicability involves essentially a robot trying to make a plan, a behavior that's not just optimal with respect to MR, but also close with respect to what would be expected from MH. And then sometimes explicability is impossible because it's just too costly to do what the human is expecting you to do, at which point they might ask for explanations. And when there's an explanation required, explanation is not just talking to yourself, but really trying to make sense of why your behavior makes sense if only the human can get a better understanding of your capabilities. So the explanation dialogue is all about getting the human to come to the same page as you in terms of your model, okay? So we actually look at it that way. So explanation, beyond explanation as soliloquy, which is essentially model comparisons. So with respect to that, the kinds of challenges we have include interpreting what humans are doing based on incomplete human preference and domain models. And now this is the incompleteness is something that came up yesterday significantly, that in open worlds we have, of course, models are incomplete. You want to think of openness, open world, talk to humans. Okay, most of the time, they don't know exactly what they want, so which is actually partially specified preferences, and they have an approximation model of what you are actually capable of. That's, again, incomplete. And so in some sense, much of your behavior now has to be taking into account these highly partially, partial models, okay? Plan with this kind of incomplete domain models, show explicable behavior, and provide explanations as needed. And when you're providing explanations, it's not just soliloquy, not talking to yourself about your model and why you're right with respect to your model, but to explain to the humans how they should change their model of your capabilities so that next time around an explanation is not needed. Okay, and then finally, we also look at understanding interactions between humans and machines. You have to evaluate these. So a bunch of engineers sort of deciding what humans would like and then providing a design could be a bit of an oxymoron. And there's a well-developed area, human factors engineering. And so, in fact, it makes sense to work with them to set up careful experimentation. So in my group, I actually work with Nancy Cook, one of my colleagues, who is a human factors society president. And actually, so they wind up doing human-human experiments, which we then bring forward to learn lessons from them and then actually design the planners, which we can then do additional human-machine experiments, which, by the way, require IRBs, institutional review board certifications. AI people typically don't even know what IRB stands for. I was one of them, 7 years back, and it turns out that it's very hard to say that people should take us seriously about how we are interested in helping humans when we don't know what IRB is, because that's what you will wind up needing if you actually work with humans. Okay, so that's that, and I'm just going to quickly make a couple of points about the challenges. One of the challenges I wanted to mention about is this, how to learn and plan with incomplete domain models. In the context of planning, essentially, we typically start with very full, causal models. That's the way typically the world has been in planning. But it turns out that since the models that you're going to use, especially of the humans' approximation of your capabilities, they are essentially not known to you. You have to learn it indirectly from traces. So we have been looking at a spectrum of models that can be learned more easily, including very shallow models. So in particular, we looked at the idea, for example, just using very shallow models like action vectors, where you think of the planned behavior, the behaviors that you have seen, as if they are sentences in the vocabulary of actions, and then just apply word vector methods. So that all you will learn is when you see this action, after a while, magically this other action might occur. Now notice that machine learning people have been trying to go from correlational models towards causal models. So planning, in my case, I'm going from causal models, which are hand-given, to correlational models because they're easier to learn. So it may well be that some of us will meet somewhere in the middle. But the point is that even these shallow models can be useful in actually providing proper collaboration with the humans. And in fact, one of the other things that we showed in some work technically is that given the same number of plan traces, sometimes learning the shallow model and using it might have a better performance than learning a full model, because the full model winds up overfitting to the data because it has too many more parameters. So that's something to keep in mind. In terms of explicability, one of the interesting issues, as I mentioned, is that you want your behavior that you're showing to be closer to the behavior that the human would expect if they solved the same planning problem with respect to their model. And so it involves not only just minimizing the cost of the plan with respect to your model, but also minimizing the distance between that plan and the plan that the human expects you to do. Except the problem, of course, is the human's model of your capabilities is an unknown, and you have to learn this from indirectly. And so we wind up actually learning it from the plan traces. And for that, we actually set up, in some cases, a way of getting using Turker's way of getting traces of robot behaviors that humans find preferable. So you can use that to, for example, learn these sorts of preferences. And in terms of the explanations itself, as I said, we want to actually get the human's model to come towards your model. And there's an Ichikai paper that will be presented in Melbourne that talks about this as a search in the space of models, so that essentially the explanation now is the deltas between the human's model and what it should have, so that the decisions that the robot has made will actually become clearer. So this is sort of beyond explanations as soliloquy, where you don't just talk to yourself saying, look, it makes sense because my model says it's correct. It's, explanations are all about the beholder's model rather than about your own model. Okay. And then there is a lot of interest in general, a bigger issue here in terms of trust in autonomy in this human-machine collaboration. Trust is a much bigger, complex issue. There is a lot of mechanisms about the long-term trust, but at least the ability of an agent to show explicable behavior and provide comprehensible explanations is clearly critical for engendering trust. So you can lose trust very easily by sort of showing incomprehensible behavior, but you can gain trust, hopefully, by, you know, on a longer term, by, you know, incremental progress. So, and I mentioned already that I work with human factors people in setting up actual experiments in the human, for the human-human studies. We actually use Minecraft before the project. The Malmo right now uses that. So some years before that, we actually were using this Minecraft environment to set human-human collaboration experiments that Nancy Cook and her colleagues would evaluate for a variety of team fluency issues, which we'll then take in designing the planners, and then we can then redo those experiments with respect to human-machine scenarios, where one of these agents is controlled by the human, one is controlled by the planner. So I'm going to end that basically there are a bunch of technical issues in terms of, at least in the context of planned behavior, how does planning as a problem change because there is a human in the loop with a different model of your own capabilities? And in a bigger summary of the talk, as in a part one, that I will try to convince you that path to general AI goes through human-machine collaboration, really. It's a, and as Barbara was saying yesterday, really it's a much bigger goal than can your robot hang around on Mars. It's much harder to hang around in the midst of us than on Mars. And then part two, I try to tell you some of the planning challenges in human-machine collaboration that we've been looking at. And I'm going to stop there and take any questions. Thank you.
So please ask if you have any questions for Rao, and in the meantime, I'm going to get Eric and Milind to the stage as well so that we can have our general discussion. Any questions for Rao?
Yes.
Yes.
Thank you. Forgot to introduce myself last time, Beth Minot from Georgia Tech, but I've just have adored this session, so thanks to all of the speakers. I love your explanation that you give to your students, which is, you know, the power that we have here has evolved about making sense of other human beings and how we really should pivot around our orientation around AI challenges. Perhaps a naive question, but are people working on systems that observe how other human beings are observing a person as additional inputs? So, for example, a security robot could be observing someone in, let's say, an airport, but taking into account how 20 other people are also reacting to that individual would be additional human wetware into making sense of that situation.
I think that's a perfectly valid set of data to gather. So, in fact, in general, in this area, data sets are reasonably sparse. In fact, one of the questions that HA asked us to think about is what data sets can we gather and put out there? And if this is the kind of data that would be very nice to gather, not just what the person, one person is doing, but what the bystanders are doing. And it would be very useful to capture that sort of a data, and hopefully we will. But right now, I don't know of anyone who is capturing that sort of data.
I think my home AI agent would just decide to ignore me by watching the faces of my children. And if my children
That's
are
possible.
Ignoring me, it would be like, yeah, just fine, ignore. Okay. Thanks.
Let's make a quick comment, Beth, is that in the situated interaction project that I was talking about, one of the, I consider the probably the key breakthrough in that project was multi-party, understanding many people coming up to the system and their relationships and making that a foundational target of representation and reasoning. Who's talking to who? When was the talking going on between two people versus the computer and so on? And so the certainly looking at multiple people and what they were doing was part of the reasoning process.
And obviously in the medical situation.
Absolutely. You can imagine people like Greg's teams of coordinating what happens in an operating room, what's going on, who's getting, who's talking to who, yeah.
So while that is the ultimate goal, I just want to challenge you to think a little differently. So I had a PhD student who just finished, Elaine Short, who actually did exactly that. She did multi-party interactions with a robot observing and moderating. The robot never knew exactly what the people were talking about. In fact, we didn't even use any natural language understanding. We could, but we didn't. It just looked at every other back channel timing information and was able to do things like moderate the conversation and get people to be more polite and in fact more kind to each other and less competitive. So yeah. I just say that because I think there's this upfront assumption that you have to do, you know, kind of AI and reasoning to achieve some of these goals. And it's really a combination of, you know, a lot of back channel as well as, you know, what are they saying, who is talking. There's a lot more going on than
that. The back channels are definitely part of the rich evidence. We don't necessarily have to do NLP to know who's talking to who and even looking at face pose and so on. So, I mean, it's your traditional Bayesian fusion of many signals.
So I guess I would just say it's rather than necessarily starting top down, you could start the other way. You could start bottom up and say, if I don't even try to understand what they're saying, but I go by these other metrics, you might go far. It ends up sometimes coming up with a very different solution.
So I think with respect to your point, I guess we already, one of the nice things about this faculty summit has been, I think, by my count, there are three panels on human AI things, including in addition to the great keynote speech. And the one, for example, on the emotions and the social skills panel, for example, was focusing much more on what can you do just by looking at specific emotional cues. And in some sense, that is important, but there are also cases where you actually, if you're doing collaborative problem solving, there's an entire behavior. It's not just trying to react to a single emotional cue. So the way I...
Yeah. And it's just important to get lots of people talking.
Exactly.
You might be surprised that there isn't a necessary path. Okay.
Path. Yes.
Yeah, this is a wonderful session. And I think I have I recently read a report. It says that robots and AI actually make social inequality worse. So what do you think? I would like to hear about your views. And if it's yes, then what should we do? And if it's not, why not? Thank you.
So you're talking about robots making social inequality worse, like brown robots versus white robots or something of that kind?
It's basically, I think it mentions about, because in order for you to acquire knowledge of robots and AI, you really need more education. In this way, according to reports, that's why I would like to hear from from you and see how would you say it. I can send you this URL, and it's not my report. Okay.
So let me take it in another direction. So I spoke with the first team that was implementing, installing first IBM robots, first IBM computer in India. So this was many years ago. And what their thing was, okay, there's a factory where this had to be installed, and there were workers outside, and their whole thing was, we're going to lose our jobs, we wouldn't let this in, there's going to be all kinds of problems. And so they wouldn't let this team in. So during a festival when these workers were out celebrating, the engineers went in, they put the computer in. Now, maybe some people lost their jobs right there and then, but on the whole, this has really helped. The economy has got, a boom, led to a booming middle class and so on and so forth. So this is a very, very complicated matter. There's so many different directions to take this in. I don't think there's a very... a clear-cut answer here. But, I know in the past when you have asked us questions, I guess in the spring when Eric and I were on this panel and you were talking about this in terms of progress. I mean, it's very gray, right? It's a sort of it's not really clear where this is going to go, but I don't think we can necessarily say it's definitely going to get worse.
So I think another point that actually one of the questions that AJ brought up for us is, are there tasks where essentially humans and robots have to work together, or do we really, humans can just completely be removed and robots can do everything? And that sort of plays into this because to some extent, you know, parts of the work that robots are doing might presumably be kind of making somebody else unemployed. But the way I see it is essentially the collaborative human AI interaction is a more interesting one because it's less about loss of jobs and more about effectiveness of what we do. You know, the humans are still in the driving seat, but they're getting this support from, you know, AI technology. It seems to me that while unemployment is, I guess, going to happen, there's no question, you know, it seems the AI, you know, human interaction keeps us a lot more in the loop for longer time. And for good reasons, because there are many important problems where, for example, I'm not sure of any of you, but I'm not yet ready for a robotic caregiver when I become old. You know, I still want like soft and fuzzy humans touching me kind of a thing. So I think it's like there are things where, you know, the collaborative aspects will basically keep us more in loop longer. And so that's like a negative, positive thing.
So I'll make a quick comment. You wanted to set the URL. There are thousands of URLs on all sides of this question, yeah. So I'm not sure if I need to read yours urgently right now. But let me just make a comment is that there's lots of uncertainty about the economic influences of various kinds of advances in machine intelligence technologies. One thing is certain, though. It's pretty clear that these advances will lead to trillions of dollars of resources injected into our economy, and the question is going to be how is that distributed and how does the AI mechanisms influence that. There was a recent National Academy of Science report that was published after 2 years of intensive study, and the key result of that, or the key guidance was, we need more data, we need more monitoring, we need more tracking, we're flying in the dark. So I'm not going to sure I need to read your URL very quickly, but you can send it to me, I'm happy to look at it.
Thanks. So I'm not sure what you meant, but I want to pick up on what Eric just said and say, I think it's not just about jobs.
Yeah.
Okay, Rao mentioned IRBs, which, by the way, you only have to get if you work with people and you're at a company and you don't take federal funds, you don't have to get an IRB.
I know
Microsoft is a good citizen in this regard, but certain other companies are. But and here I think Millen's work actually speaks to this. It's also about the data you collect and the communities you work with,
right. And
that we should be careful not to be like the psychologists who use sophomores at their universities as their subjects. And we should be careful not only in whom we work with, but also when we give talks and put up slides of the people we're studying, they shouldn't all look like Eric. They should look more like this panel.
That is the problem.
I knew it.
But we'll take a few Erics. That was all commentary, that we shouldn't just think it's all about jobs. Obviously, I like collaboration. Working with people is really, really challenging, and there are issues of privacy with respect to data. On the other hand, sharing data is really useful. So just related to that whole complex of things, I wonder if you have comments on how we can become a stronger community in sharing the data that we have, and also what we learn about how to do those experiments well.
Well, one comment I'll make is that, as many of us know in the AI community, great leaps and surprises have come of challenge problems being defined, and these days more and more with challenge data sets. We did Microsoft COCO, MS COCO. This was common objects in context that led to work at several sites and in academic centers on image captioning, photo captioning. It wouldn't have happened without that. As lab director at the time, I was asked for $250,000, and then by Larry Zitnik at the time, and then he doubled it. He wanted $500,000, and both times I took it out of my secret slush fund. And I said, this is really important. Let's go for it. And look what happened. We had like within a year, we had like a New York Times article with four senators competing with, you know, similar capabilities, different approaches to it. That's an easy problem. Let's do this. Let's do, you know, general FAQ questions. And these data sets are really critical for exploration, and they've always have been. And I think we need to really invest there. And I know we will. The partnership, I'll make one more comment. The partnership on AI has one of the goals of the partnership, and that Rao and I are part of, is to close the data divide between the large companies. Not we can do it completely, but to address the gap between large companies that have proprietary data sets and other centers that might not have access to those data sets. And I think that we're trying to work through solutions on that right now, and there's some interesting approaches.
So I guess I'll make two comments. First, with respect to sharing of data on the research side, unless there's a reward, there's some reward system that we get something out of this, somebody who makes such a data set public can publish it, get some some credit for a publication or something. It's just not something somebody will do. I understand that in other fields, like in conservation biology, this is an accepted practice. Not only do you get credit for the data, but also even for the R code or whatever that you share. And unless that becomes a standard practice, I don't see how I would advise my students to say, you know, spend your time trying to make this available and so forth. And that's something that we need to grapple with and kind of understand how that would happen. But the other part, and it's a really wonderful question here, Barbara, is some of these data, I mean, we have to go out in the field. I mean, some of this is very unclean in some sense. We don't quite understand as AI is going out into society. This is, you know, you're working in, let's say, a homeless shelter or in some park in Africa. The data is sort of very unclean. It's hard to know what we are getting. There's all kinds of restrictions and all sorts. And so there's a whole, there needs to be some kind of an understanding of how we mature as a field to share such data, and what does that really mean? It seems in conservation biology that there's a lot more of it. There's a lot more of understanding of what all this means. And I don't see that in our field yet.
So one thing in respect to, you know, even though you made it probably partly in jest, this issue of having, you know, the cultural mores taken into account when you're setting up these kinds of experiments is very important, because I think there's a fascinating amount of work on the acceptance of technology across different cultures. So, you know, in fact, even in the small experiments with explicability and explanation that we have done, there are some people who have the more of a Mr. Robot knows the right thing kind of an attitude. And so for everything the robot does is explicable for them. You know, essentially they're not particularly questioning. And there are other people who are a lot more picky. And so in general, essentially, it should not be surprising that there is no such thing as a single human. You know, and so while we tend to, you know, even in getting these kinds of data, it's going to be an issue of, is it just personalized to one person, or is it personalized to particular groups? And that's something that we need to take into account.
We have to conclude the session very soon, but Beth, if you have like a quick comment, we'll take
it. I just want to agree with Eric that it's really important to frame the conversation around disparities in AI from multiple perspectives, and jobs is clearly just one dimension. If you look at healthcare alone, whether it's improving remote diagnosis for rural medicine, or actually even in the home health scenario, our subjects like their robotic caregivers because they're less embarrassing and they don't gossip with the neighbors, right? So if you look at shortage of home health workers and possible disparities there, so there's many dimensions to societal impact and increasing disparities around this topic, and it's important for our community to keep framing it around these larger issues.
Can I invite people to come into the session at 3:45?
Just a continuation.
Thank you to the speakers again.